It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 20th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Munch District of New York City. Today on the program, on the case of Julian Assange receiving diplomatic asylum, sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy, attorney Scott Horton, writer for Harper's Magazine, and also attorney Michael Ratner, the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Julian Assange's U.S. lawyer. We'll have them on separately. And shortly, I don't know if you can pick it up today, folks, but I am feeling rather under the weather. Friday night, Myla, at around 6 to 7 p.m., developed the sniffles. By 9 p.m., she was yelling at me that it was all my fault that she couldn't breathe through her nose. By 11 p.m., she was yelling at me that it was all my fault that she had a sore throat. And we got no sleep that night. But she did manage to breathe on me enough in my face and cough at my face. Enough so that she would infect me with whatever that she had. Seems to be like a 24-hour virus. And so yesterday morning I did Up with Chris. I was home alone, so I got a chance to actually see The Dark Knight Rises. And all the while, the virus that my daughter had infected me with, because of her complete lack of gratitude for everything I've done for her in her 7 years, was developing and growing in my body. And then by last night, it struck. I got very little sleep, and I don't feel well. So today's show may be a little bit on the short side for members, but I'll do my best. The big story today, of course, the most talked about, is that the Missouri Senate candidate, Todd Akin, who I spoke about on Friday because he wanted to get, he wanted to make sure that poor kids couldn't eat in schools, now apparently also thinks that rape victims have a biological construct which allows them to prevent them from being, getting pregnant. And even then, that construct only happens when it's so-called legitimate rape. Now, he says he's misspoke. We will unpack all of this because I don't even know what – I don't even know how you walk back that statement. I don't even know what you can pretend you think you were saying. But the strategy that Claire McCaskill had of running ads in Todd Akin's favor in his primary race for the Senate campaign in Missouri, starting to look like a very good idea for her. All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Scott Horton. Majority Report listener, this episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, and they're the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You can get a free Audibly downloadable book right now at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Pick up Private Empire, Exxon Mobil and American Power by Steve Cole. I think we're going to have him on later this week. And you can get it for free right now. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. This is the last time in August, at least, maybe after, that we'll be able to offer a free one. So check it out. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Get one for free. Any book that you want.
Well, it'll make you lose your mind.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome, I guess, to this version of my program for the first time, but a frequent guest on some of my past shows, Scott Horton, writer for Harper's Magazine, among other attributes. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Hey, great to be with you.
So, Scott, let's go over. I mean, I think, you know, I think my audience is fairly aware of the basic outlines of what has happened at this point. We have now Julian Assange has been granted. My understanding is he's been granted diplomatic immunity as opposed to, asylum as opposed to political asylum. Can you tell me the difference between those two?
Well, there isn't a big distinction from in them. I mean, they have to do with the terms of his being housed, but the considerations are basically the same. So asylum is granted to an individual who applies for it, who fears persecution, or in the more extreme cases, has fear of imminent physical harm from another government. So it's actually granted against another government. And in this case, it's exceptional because the grant is occurred for the property of an embassy, because he went to the Ecuadorian embassy in London rather than going to Ecuador and made the application for Ecuador to give him asylum, which they decided to grant. Now, this is not unheard of. In fact, you may recall we have for a period of about a decade, we have a group of Russian Baptists who were granted asylum by the United States who lived in the American embassy in Moscow. We also had Cardinal Mindszenty, one of the most prominent political and religious figures in Hungarian history, who also lived for more than a decade in the American embassy in Budapest. So this is, I'd say, a very well-established practice, but not that common. It happens every few years.
Give me a sense. Characterize for me the Ecuadorian decision here. I mean, I would imagine that asylum is granted in different situations with a greater and lesser degree of, I guess, due diligence or with the qualitative decision making here. I mean, Ecuador isn't necessarily considered one of the greatest places in the world for freedom of the press, but they seem to have done a very significant amount of due diligence here, speaking both to the Swedes and to the Brits and to the U.S. Is that your sense?
That's right. I mean, there have been a number of editorials that have appeared in the United States that have said, you know, this is all just this crazy dictator in Ecuador trying to slap the American government and the British government across the face. It's just a publicity stunt. That's not really right. I mean, actually, their minister of for foreign affairs appeared and read the decision that they granted, which was really extremely detailed. And it was based on a long recitation of facts and investigation that they conducted. And to me, what struck me most about it is that they quite rigorously followed the technical legal criteria that are applied for deciding grants of asylum. So they went through the question of whether his petition was grounded in fact, whether there were threats that had been made against them. And they noted that, you know, we put questions to the Swedish government, to the British government, to the American government, didn't get much response from them. But then we also independently investigated, and we found, for instance, that a DOD spokesman did say that Julian Assange had blood on his hands, that Department of State spokesman said that Assange had put the life of American personnel in jeopardy, that there were a number of American congressmen who said that he was guilty of treason, that there were four political figures who called for the death penalty against him, that a former Speaker of the House of Representatives stated that he should be assassinated. I've been involved in many political asylum cases in the United States involving prominent foreign political figures, and this is exactly the character and nature of evidence that usually is collected and considered by an American immigration court in making that determination. So I would say they did it in a technically precise and correct way.
Now, let me ask you this. One of the questions that people have discussed is how are the extradition treaties, or how is the situation different so that that Britain would not extradite Assange? Let's assume for the moment that there is a sealed indictment waiting for Assange, or that one is imminent from the grand jury. Why would not the Brits simply extradite him as opposed to the Swedes? I mean, in other words, why would he have to go to Sweden to put himself in jeopardy as opposed to where he was in Britain?
Well, the bottom line answer to that is that there is both a practice a technical legal predicate for rendition between Sweden and the United States. And there is not between the UK and the United States. That may sound strange because we always talk about there being a special relationship with the UK. But in fact, the UK insists on a much more formal legal process. And Sweden has cooperated with the United States repeatedly in rendition. Now, rendition means that there's no formal extradition procedure. They just put someone on a plane and ship them off to the US immediately. And there may not even be an opportunity to contest it. And in this case, both the Ecuadorian government and Assange's attorneys have asked both the U.S. and Sweden deny this, and neither Sweden nor the U.S. would deny it. So, in fact, I'd say there are a lot of circumstances. I'd say there's no clear proof of there being such a wink and nod agreement between Sweden and the United States, but there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that would suggest that the fear that Assange is articulating is certainly not crazy. It's quite realistic.
Interesting. And do you think that, I mean, from the UK's perspective, how has their actions been? I mean, both, I want you to characterize, one, the threat to storm the Ecuadorian embassy, which I think by all accounts is fairly unprecedented, but also characterize what you see as the relationship between Swedish authorities and UK authorities in terms of their request for the custody of Assange. Do you think that the UK Do you think the UK is conscious of what will happen to Assange, or if he goes to Sweden, or have they, and is that indicative of their threat to storm the Ecuadorian embassy?
Well, let's deal with that threat first of all. I mean, I was when you first called me about this, I was giving a presentation at the Practicing Law Institute, where I appeared with a very prominent, very conservative American international law scholar, Malvina Halberstam, who told me she was absolutely appalled at what she heard the UK threatened to do, destroying this embassy. I mean, you know, this is not a question of politics or attitude. I mean, the law in this area is absolutely clear-cut. You may not do that. And this is the sort of threat that rogue nations make. I mean, like, I would expect this to come from the Iranians or the Syrians or something, but not to come from the UK. So that was really, I think, had a lot of people completely aghast that they made this threat. And then secondly, I'd say, there's something about this that just doesn't quite stand up. I mean, Assange does not face any criminal charges in Sweden. There's only an investigation going on. There's an investigation, and the investigation itself is highly controversial, with some very, very prominent Swedish legal figures saying that this is just hooey. There's no basis for any criminal action here, including the former Arnhelm, the former prosecutor general of Stockholm, who said that this is nonsense. It's some sort of intrigue. And we know that when the process was first opened based on these complaints, the senior prosecutor in that district shut it down, and then it was strangely again reopened. So there's something really odd there. Now, the major complaint that Assange brought in his case in the British courts was that Britain had a duty to ensure that this was not just some sort of collusive arrangement between the U.S. and the Swedes, where he was going to be sent to the U.S. to face espionage charges or heaven only knows what. The British courts, going all the way to the top, basically said, well, you really don't have enough evidence of that to push it. And Britain really is committed through its treaty undertakings with Sweden to go ahead and turn someone over for inquiries, even when there is no pending criminal charge. So I say, you know, what's going on is highly unusual, but not impossible legally. But it definitely points to there being something under the surface here.
Right. And Britain's it's one thing to say that they are obligated to send someone back to Sweden for questioning. It's another to say that they will actually take that obligation to the point of saying, we will storm an embassy that has provided asylum to him. Right. I mean,
that's exactly right. And in fact, you look at a lot of the stories that have been presented in the British press about how this is an affront to British sovereignty and British dignity, and the Ecuadorians are attacking Britain. It was described by The Sun as the Second Falkland Islands War. I mean, this is all total nonsense. This really has nothing to do with the UK. The UK is an intermediary acting on the Swedish request. So, I mean, and in fact, the party of interest in the background really is the United States. The important thing to consider here is that if the U.S. is looking at this, it's a national security violation in the U.S., a whistleblowing offense or something of that sort. And that is the sort of claim or charge for which a country frequently cannot get the cooperation of a foreign country. And because this is a sort of crime which we would say is essentially political in its nature. So, you know, any country can charge such offenses and try them in their courts, but countries usually don't cooperate with one another in the enforcement of political crime.
And we should say, just, you know, to that point, the Sydney Morning Herald reported at the end of last week, I should say, that through freedom of information requests, they reported that at the very least, Australian authorities are operating under the assumption or the belief or is anticipating the receipt of an extradition request for Assange from the U.S. So that's just more evidence that there is a There is at least the some type of charges waiting for Assange in the U.S. And tell me, do you know anything about how Sweden charges someone with a crime? I've read contradicting reports that they can't charge Assange in absentia. Is that true to the best of your knowledge, or is that not true?
It is true that they can't try someone in absentia, but they can charge someone in absentia. So there's no reason why they wouldn't be able to bring charges right now. But of course, it's also a procedural norm that prosecutors usually don't want to bring charges until they've had an opportunity to interview principal witnesses, and they're considering Assange to be one. And you know, what is the crime or offense here? It has to do with Assange having sexual relations with two women who both have told prosecutors that they consented to have sexual relations with him, but then withdrew the consent in the course of the sexual relations, and he continued and completed the act. So let's just say this is the sort of thing which is not charged as a sexual offense in any country in the world I'm aware of. You know, I'm told that, you know, it is a violation of the law in Sweden, apparently, but there's no real record of the Swedes prosecuting anyone for this. This is one of the reasons why a lot of people in Sweden just say this just doesn't pass the smell test.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from my perspective, the issue is simply, you know, I'll leave it to the Swedes to determine what their law is. But, I mean, if he can be charged while he's outside of the country, and he, to my understanding, he has been questioned already once. But we're going to be talking to Michael Ratner in just a few moments, and so we can get that clarified. Scott Horton, I appreciate your weighing in on this. Is there anything else that you think that we're not that needs to be touched on?
Well, I think one thing I would just focus on is one of these early WikiLeaks documents was a leaked U.S. Department of Defense dossier that said that provided a strategy for battling WikiLeaks, and it basically talked about using dirty tricks and very aggressive techniques to go after the leadership of the WikiLeaks organization and their financial resources. So we know that the U.S. government was planning to use, let's say, dark means to try and shut WikiLeaks down. I think if we look at what's happened to Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks organization subsequently, I think you could put together a case that that game plan may very well have been implemented.
Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Okay, we've got to take a quick break, folks. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Michael Ratner, the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and Julian Assange's U.S. attorney. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, and on the phone, the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the One of the U.S. attorneys, if not the U.S. attorney, for Julian Assange, Michael Ratner. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Good to be with you, Sam.
Michael, let's, we were getting some analysis of this from Scott Horton from Harper's Magazine, and I want to just dig in a little bit deeper. Can you tell us at this point, what processes, legal processes, has Julian Assange gone through with the Swedish authorities? In other words, my understanding is they've already questioned him once and still have yet to bring charges. Is that correct?
They questioned him once. He actually asked for and made sure he had authorization to leave the country, and he did. And only after that fact did they file an extradition request to the United Kingdom, which he challenged for various reasons. One of them was a pretty interesting one, saying they didn't make it in the right way because it was a prosecutor making it and not a judge. He ultimately lost that a couple of months ago in the UK, and now he's subject to extradition to Sweden for questioning on allegations that are made by the two women. There's been no criminal charge, and he's very he's vehement about that he's not been charged. It's for questioning. And for me, the critical issue here at this point, I mean, we don't know what happened in Sweden, obviously, but is that we've had this huge diplomatic brouhaha. We've had the UK threaten to go into the mission, or the embassy, rather. And all that has to happen here, particularly because it's only about questioning, is Sweden could go to the United Kingdom, and they've been invited to come there by Ecuador and question Julian Assange at the embassy. The fact that they've been unwilling to do that, that Sweden, which has done this in other cases, is unwilling to do that, makes one very suspicious, not necessarily about the women or the credibility or any of that, but just about the motives behind the Swedish efforts here to extradite and get Julian Assange to Sweden.
I asked this of Scott Horton, but I'm curious as to your perspective on this. Why, if the United States wanted to extradite Julian Assange, why couldn't they do it directly from Britain? Why this step of him having to go to Sweden first?
Yes, I think it's a very good question. One is, while there's an extradition request pending for him to go to Sweden, it gums it up a lot if one comes in from another country, because then the country has to decide which to go to, etc. But that the underlying issue is, I think about it for myself. If I were in Julian Assange's situation, sitting in England, where would I rather be facing an extradition to the U.S.? And the answer is, I'd rather be in the United Kingdom. I think for a couple of reasons. One is, Sweden has a very rapid exception to their normal extradition process called temporary surrender. And they can bypass a lot of legal protections in Sweden. They can't do that in the United Kingdom. Secondly, Julian Assange has a huge amount of support in the United Kingdom. And that, where he does not have that same kind of support in Sweden. And thirdly, the fight on extradition in England can take a very long time. There's a man there now named McKinnon, young man who supposedly hacked into the Pentagon computer to look for hidden evidence of UFOs. He has now been fighting extradition in the United Kingdom for not one, but 8 years.
Wow.
So there's a lot of support. And the last reason is, in Sweden, he will be in jail immediately. Julian Assange is put in jail without bail immediately. In the UK, he will be free while he is fighting extradition. So there's a lot of reasons why one would rather fight an extradition in the United Kingdom than in Sweden. The process that could happen here is, if he would take him to Sweden, no bail, in jail, U.S. files the extradition, and he's whisked out of there very quickly.
And so the flip side of that, of course, is, from the United States perspective, if you want to get a hold of this guy as quickly and cleanly as possible, to the extent that that's even possible now, but I mean, relatively speaking, it behooves you to have him in Sweden as opposed to the U.K.
Yes, that was your real question. I was going on about other things.
No, no, but I mean, I think
that are related. But that is your question, right? If you were sitting in the United States, you want to get this guy in Sweden. One is, both countries, of course, act often like, you know, poodles of the United States. But Sweden is really a bad reputation in terms of just bending to the United States. It sent two people to be tortured in Egypt at the behest of the U.S. CIA shortly after 9/11. It bends itself quite often to U.S. Without really a lot of public support for Julian Assange. So you would, and the process is much more rapid, as I said, in Sweden. So that there's no doubt that, if, from the U.S. perspective, if it wants to get its hands on Julian Assange without a huge brouhaha, et cetera, they're going to want to get him out of Sweden.
Now, I mean, it's almost moot as to whether or not Julian Assange, I mean, at this point, is right to fear U.S. prosecution because he has been offered and granted diplomatic asylum on that premise. So there's been a sort of like a third or fourth party, I guess, in this case that has made that determination that his fear is legitimate. But give us a sense of the reasons why Ecuador and Julian Assange are correct in fearing prosecution from United States authorities.
Yeah, well, I've been following this for a long time. The Center for Constitutional Rights and myself have been representing Julian really for almost a couple of years now. We've been following, obviously, closely the Bradley Manning case, the person who was allegedly the young private who gave the documents to WikiLeaks. And the reason I think Julian Assange is not just it's a completely reasonable fear he has of being persecuted in the U.S. The first thing is look at how Bradley Manning was treated, 9 months underground cell, solitary, stripped to the bone, what the U.N. rapporteur called cruel and inhuman treatment, equivalent of torture. That's how you could expect Julian Assange to be treated, the same way as the center's Guantanamo clients are treated or were treated, which is to say no communications with the outside world, et cetera. The second thing that's going on is there's been a grand jury sitting in one of the most conservative districts in the United States, in Alexandria, Virginia, which is, of course, the home of more national security establishments that you can count when and if you ever get a jury. And they have been looking at indicting Julian Assange for conspiracy to commit espionage. That's pretty clear from that grand jury. One of the witnesses has actually gone public with regard to that grand jury. The number of the grand jury is the number of the espionage statute. So we have that factor. Then at the Bradley Manning case, which has been going on at Fort Meade in some of the most secretive conditions that I've ever been at in a trial, an FBI agent testified that we are looking at the managers, the founders, et cetera, of WikiLeaks, who we believe are involved in criminality. So there's no doubt the U.S. wants to get him. And then there's no doubt they want to get him on espionage, which of all the statutes in the world, not all, but is among the most politically misused. It was passed during the First World War, just around that time, to suppress dissent, to suppress people like Eugene B. Debs, who was jailed for opposing entry into the First World War and the draft. So it's one that's aimed at speech. It's one that's rarely been used recently for speech. It's used more against the Bradley Manning types, who actually have access to classified material. But in this case, it looks like they're pushing, the U.S. government is pushing and is going to use it for the reason the statute was passed originally, which is to suppress truth-telling and speech.
Can you outline to me, I mean, let's assume for a moment that Bradley Manning had not used WikiLeaks essentially as an intermediary to get this, at least the first round of hundreds, if not thousands of cables, published in the New York Times, in the Guardian, in international papers around the world. Had Bradley Manning just sent these directly to the New York Times, to a reporter at the New York Times, to the editor of the New York Times, and the Times just directly published these cables, or the Guardian, whomever.
Yeah, the question is why.
Do you think that Bill Keller would be brought in under these espionage charges? I mean, obviously not. But I mean, how is that reconciled?
I don't think they can really reconcile it. I mean, I think, you know, one of the early claims was that, well, you know, the newspapers are, quote, responsible, and they only put out the things that they thought wouldn't hurt national security, et cetera. And you do hear this kind of stuff from the New York Times that, you know, before they, for example, published the warrantless wiretapping material that James Risen, their reporter, got a hold of, they went to the White House and they said, well, can we publish it? But what do you think of this? And they said, well, wait a while. And the Times waited a while. So the Times looks at itself as, quote, a responsible journalist. They look at WikiLeaks, or at least they in part did, as is not as responsible. And I think the U.S. government is playing off on that and saying, well, we can go after WikiLeaks, even though we wouldn't go after the Times and the Guardian. On the other hand, Sam, you know, they have made noises about going after Risen. I mean, not right now. Risen is fighting being a witness in the case of in one of the national security cases. This is the Times reporter. But they did under Bush say, well, maybe we ought to indict Risen for espionage. And he would then be, of course, in a similar situation as Julian Assange. But they didn't do it is the whole point, and they won't, because they are not going to take on the, quote, fourth estate, at least the more established fourth estate, which is the Times, the Guardian, Wall Street Journal, et cetera.
What is the precedent? I mean, let's assume that the United States manages to try Julian Assange under espionage or any other, indictment. What is the precedent set at that point? I mean, I imagine if I am a New York Times reporter, never mind if I am WikiLeaks 2 or whatever, but I imagine that if I am James Risen or anonymous reporter, ex-reporter from the New York Times in the future, I'm going to think 2, 3, 5, 10 times before I publish anything like, just for instance, what we knew about Watergate, for that matter.
You know, I think they already are, Sam. I think reporters are already thinking about that because of the noise made, particularly about, not noise, but because of the grand jury sitting on WikiLeaks right now, because because of what happened with Risen and the saber rattling there. So I think they're already thinking about it. I think the scenario you draw is very bad. I think it would be a huge blow. Just a giant blow to First Amendment rights in this country to go after journalists, publishers like WikiLeaks, and it would send an incredibly chilling message. We call it the chilling effect in law, because it chills people in vigorously asserting their First Amendment rights. So I think news media has an absolute obligation to get behind Julian Assange and WikiLeaks on this issue and say, look, they can say whatever they want, but they certainly should be supporting his right to publish freely.
And so what happens now is Julian Assange, if he gets into an Ecuadorian diplomatic, car with a diplomatic license plate, I assume, and drives to the airport. I mean, is there any sort of scenario where there is safe passage, or is it one of those things like if there's any opportunity? I mean, let me take it in stages. If he gets into an Ecuadorian car in the embassy and they drive outside onto the streets of Britain, can he be stopped and pulled out of that car?
Well, I would argue that he is a protected person under asylum law, and as you pointed out, he really can't be sent to a country that's going to persecute him, the very country he was given asylum for. So I think it's illegal to take him out of the car. It's illegal to stop him from getting safe passage. But we are on territory here that, you know, has not really been looked at, and the problem is it's not that it's not been looked at, it's contentious. And so if you're Julian Assange, you know you're protected in the embassy. At least we thought so until the British made their claim that they were going to raid the embassy and got slapped down pretty hard about that, very hard, which actually, I think, hurt the UK a lot. But that's protected. You leave that embassy, I think it's in an area in which the British will say there's not precedent for us to prevent arresting him, and we will. And so I think that's a high risk for Julian Assange to leave that embassy. So what has to happen now is there has to be negotiations to get him a safe passage to Ecuador, which I think he's entitled to under international law. And when I opened this discussion with you, I said what's crazy to me is this, and what makes one very suspicious is the fact that there's been no effort by Sweden to come and question him in the UK, no effort by the United States to say we have no plans to prosecute him, no efforts by the United Kingdom to say if we send him to Sweden, he can't be forwarded to the United States. It looks to me like everything's at play here from the major countries to try and get him into the hands of the United States. And I do think it's a problem now, because this is not, even if this were a grand embassy, as during the Cold War people lived in for 12 or 15 years, like Cardinal Maczynski in Hungary, this is some small little embassy, and Julian Assange is in a study there. How long can he stay there? How long will this diplomatic, standoff go on, I can't say. Right now, I think Julian Assange, because of what's happened over the last couple of days with Britain acting with such saber-rattling toward a small country, has been pushing heavily in WikiLeaks and Julian Assange's favor.
And so, I mean, are you aware of any negotiations that are going on between the Ecuadorians and the Brits, or Ecuadorians and the Swedes and the U.S.? I mean, are you aware of what negotiations are happening now?
At this very moment, I'm not. I haven't checked in today or yesterday, but over the last few weeks, there have been extensive efforts by the Ecuadorians to get the Swedes to either come to the United Kingdom, which they did not do, or to get guarantees of whatever of a kind that can protect Julian from being sent to the United States from Sweden. Julian Assange would go to Sweden tomorrow if he had the protection from Sweden or the United Kingdom or from the United States, saying he will not be extradited to the United States, because what he fears here is the United States. The Swedish matter, whatever happened in Sweden, will be resolved one way or another. We're not talking about, you know, life sentences here like we're talking about in the United States. We're not talking about, you know, conditions where he never will see the light of day for 40 years.
So he has been explicit that he is willing to face any legal consequences out of this accusations of sexual assault in Sweden, as long as he has assurance that he will not be extradited to the U.S. So he is fully 100% committed to facing those charges if he has the protection of no extradition to the United States.
Yes, he's been very clear on that. If he can get guaranteed no extradition to the U.S., he will go to Sweden. He will answer the sexual misconduct allegations. And I just want to say a couple of things that some people occasionally call them charges. He has not been charged in Sweden. There are allegations against him regarding sexual misconduct. He is willing to answer those. He's willing to go to Sweden on the one condition that he will not be extradited to the United States. It's not Sweden he fears. Sweden is an unbroken link in the chain of going to the United States, and that's what he was given asylum for what would happen to him if and when the U.S. gets its hands on him.
And so, do you have any sense of what happens now? I guess it's just waiting to see if there can be. I guess it's either we're going to do some negotiations or hope for an administration, either the U.S. administration changing its mind. I mean, clearly there's obviously some pressure here, right? Because Britain's actions of questioning whether or not they're going to storm the embassy seem to be pretty unprecedented for them to do this. Because there's a suspect who needs to be questioned on a
right.
Sexual assault. I mean, that seems to be just...
Seems crazy, right?
It's just impossible
how did this
to
happen?
Imagine that's what this is about. So clearly they're getting either they are upset and want to sort of unilaterally decide, like, we want to push him to Sweden with the hopes that he'll be extradited to the United States, or the U.S. is pushing them. But clearly it can't just be about that. That just seems...
No, it seems crazy. The whole thing seems crazy to me, and that's why, you know, one of the points should clearly be to push Sweden to go there and question the guy. I mean, that should happen. Sweden's done this before. They've done this in other cases. There's a recent precedent. They did it. They sent somebody to Serbia to question somebody about allegations involving a murder. I mean, they do it. And why they aren't doing it here is inexplicable. And why the British would go so far outside of the law to say we're going to storm the embassy seems completely nuts to me. If we were only talking about Julian Assange answering questions about sexual misconduct in Sweden,
let me ask you this: do you think that the Swedish authorities are reluctant to charge Julian Assange because that would complicate extraditing him to the United States?
I don't know the answer to that, Sam. They have that's what Sweden has that other countries don't have. If he were extradited to Sweden, and even if he were charged, it's my understanding that if the U.S. asks for him, they can do something called temporary or conditional surrender. They can surrender him to the United States in a faster manner than normal extradition, even though they have charges pending against him in Sweden. They don't, as I said, but even assuming if they were to charge him, he could still be extradited to the United States. But it does, I agree with you, it gets a bit more complicated.
And I would think not just complicated from a legal perspective, but I would also imagine from a political perspective that to the extent that Assange does not have support in Sweden, that the Swedish population would be a little bit more upset about the notion that this guy is not going to address charges of sexual assault, but rather is going to the United States. I mean, that seems to me to present a slightly different political equation for the Swedish government.
I agree with that, Sam. Well, while always reiterating at this point, there's only allegations. And it's conceivable that there's only allegations because maybe they don't have enough evidence to indict him yet or to charge him with the crime. Or it's equivocal enough that they need to hear from him. So I don't know the answer about Sweden. You know, I don't know anything about the Swedish actual merits. But I know that all it is now is allegations and that he has not been charged with the crime.
Michael Ratner, the president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and U.S. attorney for Julian Assange. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's always good to be with you.
All right, folks. That is we're going to be taking a break and heading into the better half of the program. If you want to be a part of that better half of the program, 646-257-3920 is the phone number. I will do my best to endeavor to not pass out because of the cold that my daughter foisted on me. You can also IM this program at Majority FM on AOL or any of the other clients. Or if you can't reach us that way, you can also IM us through Majority FM at Jabber.org. Folks, it is your support that makes programming such as this, Scott Horton, Michael Ratner, possible. And it is the members who provided that show for you today and provide you a show every day. People who subscribe to the show, they get bonus material every day. They get swag in the form of some of my past DVD work. And soon they will also have full access to the Majority Report 1 archives and Sam Cedar Show archives from years gone past. There are all sorts of benefits to being a member, but the fact of the matter is what they're doing is paying for the existence of the entire show, including the portion that many of you listen to for free. So if you can become a member at majority.fm, it behooves all of us for you to do so. You can also support the show in other ways, justcoffee.coop, 10% coupon code, majority, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. You can get the Majority Report blend, buy crap through our Amazon link. If you buy crap through Amazon, at majority.fm, support the show, /support the show. Many other ways. We'll see you in the better half.